Okay, so I'll turn it back over to Anna and Dr. Trexler, and they'll give us a presentation followed by questions and answers.
Hello, Dr. Trexler here. Who do we have on the line?
Mary has entered the conference.
Right now we've got, I think, about 8 people from different projects around the country. They can introduce themselves if you like, or however you'd like to do that.
Okay, that would be great. Just to get some kind of a real brief background on what you folks are engaged in so we better understand exactly your activities, and then I can better address what we'd like to share.
Just in general, the everybody that's on the call is involved in some way with the AgriBility project around the country that assists farmers and other agricultural workers with disabilities.
So
I think we've got, we've got some from Vermont, Minnesota, Indiana, Oklahoma. I'm not sure. I didn't get everybody else written down, so if you want to.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I certainly know a little bit about your effort. You guys have been well-publicized, or at least I have been on your website and seen some of your activities and so forth, and they sound just, it sounds like an extremely cool project. So, what we'd like to review with you today is a little bit about our HRSA grant, and I don't know if you folks are familiar with HRSA, the Human Resource Service Administration. It's part of the Department of Health, and what the main focus of it is for us to help return people that have experienced brain injury back to work. And one of the particular priorities of our grant is focused on the rural population of Indiana. So as such, we have a number of people involved in agriculture, both directly and indirectly, that we are serving. Part of the problem historically with people with brain injury is that the nature of their impairments are either not recognized or well understood. So a person with a brain injury may have impairments of memory, for example, or attention or concentration. They may have physical deficits too that are more obvious, such as, you know, weakness on one side or impairments with coordination. But typically it's more in the cognitive domain. Probably the most problematic impairments emerge in terms of what we call executive functions, and by that I mean planning and organizing and sequencing their overall behavior so that it's consistent with what their goals are. So a person may want to get up and do their chores and take care of things on their farm or repair equipment and so forth, but may get started in that activity and then get distracted into something else, and then may end up watching the news, and then may fall asleep and take a nap, and then at the end of the day wonder why they didn't get done what they wanted to get done that day, or their companion or spouse may wonder why they didn't get done what they were wanting to do. The other domain of difficulties can be in what's called the neurobehavioral domain, and by that I mean behaviors that are really dependent on brain function, such as regulating your own emotions. So someone that has a brain injury may tell their boss what they're thinking despite the fact that they maybe shouldn't, for example. Or failed to put the brakes on when they're in a discussion with their spouse about a financial problem. And so they can be irritable sometimes, they can be impulsive sometimes, or do things without thinking about it.
Has entered the conference.
or they may have mood swings that really are unprovoked. It may be not clear why one moment this person with a brain injury is pleasant and cooperative, and then quite spontaneously a few minutes later may be very low or irritable or even aggressive. So returning to work for this population is a real problem because of all of these sorts of cognitive and behavioral changes. With that said, and by the way, please interrupt me with questions as they come up or comments. But the returning to work process is sometimes really aided or facilitated, especially in a rural setting. And the reason for that is that there's often the presence of a variety of natural supports in those environments that may not be the case in an urban environment. So their affiliate, their family support, their support and engagement with neighbors, their participation in the activities in small communities may actually represent a wealth of natural supports that can really assist that person in reintegrating in their home environment and in their community and in their job. The problem is that there's usually not a mechanism or a system or a process to engage those natural supports in a way that helps the patient and the family cope and return to work. Secondly, the disadvantages associated with a rural environment are that there may be a lack of access to expertise and professional resources that know how to manage and deal with these issues. So these circumstances have led us to develop what we call resource facilitation services. And resource facilitation is kind of a sophisticated kind of case management, if you will. But the focus of resource facilitation is to identify people while they're still in the hospital. And this resource facilitator begins immediately to educate people in the family, people in the environment, their employer, about the nature of brain injury, to help them identify resources that may be available either locally or regionally that can be brought in to help them function and return to work in that environment, and coordinate and time those services in a way to optimally use those natural supports that may be in place. So we developed this model in a previous grant back in 2008, and then conducted what was the first randomized controlled trial of resource facilitation. So what we did in this study, and it was just published last year in the Journal of Head Trauma Rehabilitation, We identified people just as they were leaving our rehabilitation hospital and randomly assigned them to either regular follow-up or resource facilitation services. So the people that got assigned to the regular follow-up got whatever it was that they would ordinarily get. So maybe that would be some therapies, occupational or physical or speech therapies in their local hospital. There might be a regular follow-up with one of the rehabilitation doctors here in Indianapolis, but we did nothing to alter the course of their care. In the resource facilitation group, those patients and their families were assigned a resource facilitator who's trained in brain injury and experienced with helping people navigate resources. They were seen at least every other week. And part of the reason, or part of the issue that we feel like is very important is a proactive model of resource navigation. And that's why we contacted them and followed up with them either in person or on the telephone every 2 weeks. And in the interim, that resource navigator or resource facilitator was actively engaging both natural supports or purchased services that would be assistance to that person in helping them return to work. We also staffed each case every 2 months, and by that I mean that their case was reviewed by a clinical team to ensure that all of the appropriate medical, clinical, rehabilitation services that that person might need were in fact being delivered. So we provided 6 months of resource facilitation to these patients, and at the end of that 6 months, we took a look at both our controls and our resource facilitation subjects to see where they were, in fact, as outcome measures. The outcome measures we used were return to work. We also used an instrument called the Mayo-Portland Adaptability Inventory, which measures the extent to which they're independent at home and in the community. Those were our two primary outcome measures. What we found in our analyses, first of all, was that the two groups were comparable, so the randomization process worked. They were comparable in terms of severity of injury. They were equivalent in terms of age and sex, pre-injury vocational status. What we found was that at the end of 6 months, 64% of the people who received resource facilitation had returned to work versus 36% of the controls, which was very significant statistically. When we looked at the Mayo Portland data, we also found that both groups improved in terms of their independence at home over that 6 months, and they both improved in terms of community reintegration. But the interaction effect was significant, meaning that the treatment group showed a significantly better outcome at 6 months in terms of independence at home independence and functioning in the community. So that was a very nice outcome. And as I said, the study was published in the Journal of Head Trauma Rehabilitation.
Question?
Yeah, please.
Can you hear me on the speakerphone okay?
Sure can.
Okay. How many were in the study? How many, the number? And how many facilitators did you use?
Good question. There was only 22 subjects in this pilot study, 11 in each group. And based on that, we've been refunded to do a larger randomized control trial of 80 subjects. And so far, I can tell you to date that our return to work rate is actually better than 64% in our treatment group. So things seem to be working out pretty well.
And the resource facilitators.
I'm sorry?
And what about the number of facilitators?
And on the first trial, we had one resource facilitator. So, yeah, just one person.
Okay.
Now we have three working on this. But we then conducted an economic impact. Well, actually, we didn't conduct it. Where did that slide go? We conducted an economic impact study in collaboration with Ball State University. And we wanted to just see how did this all translate into dollars, particularly because we were coming up on a legislative session with no money. So what Ball State did was they looked at just the wages associated with the sample that we looked at, and what they found was that if people in Indiana with brain injury received resource facilitation services, that would have a $31 million impact in terms of gained wages or it would avoid lost wages of $31 million. And in addition to that, they found that there would be an additional $10 million in business tax revenues associated with that. So this, of course, caught the attention of our some of our key legislators, we made a few pieces of progress in this last legislative session based on that. And those that aggregate $30 million is an annual basis. So I think while not billions of dollars on an annual basis, if you aggregate that in terms of lost earnings over the lifespan of a person with a brain injury, does indeed become billions of dollars. The other piece that we're just now applying for new funding on is to include the economic impact study on our replication trial for 80 with the 80 subjects. And there we'll also look at what are the cost savings associated with Medicaid dollars and with disability dollars, health care costs, and the like. Because in the previous study that I mentioned, we did not look at cost avoidance as it relates to health care expenses or Medicaid or disability or any of the associated expenses. So that's kind of a real thumbnail sketch of the project. For those of you in I should also mention that the cost of service for resource facilitation in our first trial, which is consistent with what we're experiencing in our second trial, was about $1,000 a person. So it's not an expensive intervention. I wanted to mention too that you mentioned that there's someone from Vermont and someone from Minnesota maybe on the call. Your states have very sophisticated resource facilitation services available through the Minnesota Brain Injury Association, excuse me, and also through the Vermont Brain Injury Association. And there's also excellent resource facilitation services available in Iowa, if anyone is out there from Iowa. We just happen to be a research center that's studying the impact of resource facilitation, but these services are available in a couple of different places throughout the United States. I think we were particularly interested in your project because your goals seem very similar in terms of trying to get people back to work, and I think we would have a lot to learn from you guys in terms of what works and what doesn't work in your experience. I don't know to what extent you folks serve people with brain injury, but I thought it might be interesting to have a conversation as it relates to not only the commonality of goals, but also from a service and research perspective. So that's kind of what led me to want to speak to your group.
Just in terms of our statistics, is something that Agribility deals with. It's not at the top of the list right now in terms of prevalence of disabilities that we address. I'd say, just from my recollection, that some of the top disabilities that we've deal with traditionally would be back injuries, amputations, some type of paralysis, arthritis. But brain injury is something that I know we in Indiana with our program have dealt with, and it's probably, at least from talking to our direct services person, seems to be one of the more difficult disabilities to kind of know how to deal with.
Right, absolutely.
I'm not sure if there's others from around the country that might want to share their perspectives on that if they've dealt with others with brain injury.
of Tom Yutman from Vermont. We have three farmers that we're working with that have TBIs. We have worked with the Vermont Brain Association and started a support group in an underserved area of our state, and we find them very helpful, and it's very helpful to the farmers to be associated with other peers that have the same type of injuries, and we'll talk the same language and understand why they're slow, why they don't respond, why you can't talk loud, why, you know, and we realize that every brain injury is different. Once you've met a brain injury, you've met one brain injury, that all of them aren't the same. So it's been a good experience for us out here.
Terrific. That's great to hear. That's terrific.
Well, it's Anna from the Brain Injury Association of Indiana. I think nationally we're seeing a couple of things, particularly with the returning veterans. I think one of the most recent reports released from the Department of Defense is that our veterans are returning home, and over 40% of them are residing in rural communities. And so, again, you know, the complexity of addressing post-traumatic stress syndrome, as well as all of the post-concussive issues that are related to TBIs, really creates some challenges for the rural access hospitals in those communities. So again, you know, one of our challenges and opportunities is increasing awareness and understanding of diagnosis as well as overall management.
Yeah, I wonder also if it's the case and maybe the goals of your project really don't focus on someone with a non-physical disability, but I think that often people with brain injury are either not identified or they are misdiagnosed as having psychiatric kinds of difficulties.
You do, yeah. It really does deal with, you know, both visible and non-visible disabilities, emotional disabilities, either as a consequence of a physical disability or just as a disability in itself.
Well, 60% of the people with brain injury, including just concussion, will develop depression within the first year of their injury, or an anxiety disorder or some other related psychological response. Yeah.
I think we've not addressed that as much, though, until more recent years, the mental health piece. So that's really good to know that the overlay is there for this as well.
Yeah. In terms of the scope of your project, though, or the goals of your project, I'm not sure I caught the previous comment. Does it explicitly include non-physical disabilities?
Yes, it's not, the non-physical disabilities are not as prevalent, but we do definitely list other disabilities that, you know, non-physical disabilities that we deal with.
Yeah, okay. All right.
This is Kirk Ballin.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, this is Kirk Ballin, Virginia. My question to you has to do with the people you've worked with, and you say you work with rural communities, and you mentioned farmers, but is there something distinctively different about working with farmers that you found yourself, or are you aware of there being anything that sets them apart, or is that something that perhaps needs further exploration?
Well, I think there is absolutely no objective or empirical research on the distinction between rural versus urban resource facilitation or return to work. And that's a hugely interesting idea all by itself. But I can tell you that while I grew up on a farm in middle Indiana, and so I'm familiar with the culture and what that's like. And I can tell you that in my working with lots and lots of patients, it's often my experience that if you can proactively and positively engage natural supports for the rural family, that this is often the linchpin, if you will, or the key factor. Many of my patients and their families have natural supports in that environment that my urban patients don't. But I think it's critical to identify those natural supports and maintain them as supportive, because without that engagement, natural supports tend to withdraw over time because they don't understand the nature of the disability. They don't understand the change in the behavior. They don't understand why the person functions in a different way because they may look exactly the same as they did before. And so, again, it's often attributed to psychiatric problems or just something you don't understand. So yes, I think there are some critical differences, but those are observational on my part,
right?
Not empirically tested as yet.
Because I would think related to that is the fact that returning to work for somebody in an urban area as opposed to someone returning to work on the farm is a very different animal as well, in some cases literally, because you're dealing with so many different factors when you're returning to work on the farm,
right?
In terms of what defines work in the job, and there's so many different dimensions to it.
Right. Well, you know, I want to just very briefly tell you about a case just to exemplify this. I had a gentleman from southern Indiana who was leading a very large bull into a fairground, and something spooked the bull, and the bull drug this young man into a fence at full gallop. He suffered a very severe brain injury, and one of his impairments was that he became blind as a consequence. He absolutely loved taking care of animals, but now we have a blind and a cognitively impaired gentleman who wants to be out running around in a pen with a bunch of bulls and cows and steers and so forth and so on. So what we did was we worked with that family over the course of a year and a half so that he could reengage in taking care of these animals in a controlled environment on a one-by-one basis, and doing such things as washing them and feeding them, but in a context in which he could do it. So now he's a useful member of that family and of that farm. He just has to go about it and doing it in a different way. So
that's a good example.
Really. Sounds like agribility at work.
But it's also an example that's very clear. I mean, there was an accident. He was blind. You know, he hit his head. It seems to me that there are a lot of examples that you're going to see where it's not going to be that obvious, and that the farmer is not necessarily going to say, well, yes, you know, ever since I had this accident, I have been depressed.
Right.
And so how do you deal with something that is not obvious and maybe not even, you know, a person is pretty much in denial?
Well, you know, that's a beautiful question. So there are two forms of denial after brain injury. One form of denial, the medical term is called anosognosia, which refers to a neurologic unawareness. The brain is a funny thing in that it monitors its own functioning. It has systems in it that monitor whether you are achieving the goals that you want to achieve. So in some cases, when your brain is injured, you may be completely unaware that you're not functioning in the right way because the monitors of the brain have been affected, which is different than a psychological denial, which basically is driven by how painful it is emotionally to acknowledge that your functioning has now been impaired. And so the management strategies are different based on whether it's a neurologic unawareness or denial versus a psychological unawareness or denial. And that's where the clinicians have to come in and put together some strategies to help with that kind of thing. But certainly both are treatable and both are manageable if they're correctly identified. So
Now, are there cases where it's unclear that to the individual that a brain injury even occurred? I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, the typical causes of brain injury, which you can elaborate on, but in most cases, is there any question about whether or not the brain injury actually occurred?
Yes. That tends to occur in the mild traumatic brain injury or in the concussion area. Certainly, I've had a number of patients with concussion that didn't even realize that it was a clinically significant event until they realized a month later that they couldn't balance their checkbook or that they were making decisions that were impulsive and the like.
Okay.
So sometimes we have to help them identify why their functioning has changed. I just want to kind of share another case story with you real briefly. This was another gentleman in rural Indiana who was using a nail gun to put together some blocks because he had to jack up one of his combines. And unfortunately, he tripped on the hose of the nail gun and shot a nail into his heart. He then went into cardiac arrest and had a condition that's called hypoxic encephalopathy, or not enough oxygen to the brain. And so now he has severe memory impairment. And I was involved in working on his family farm and also doing part-time construction with his father. So one of the things we've done with this guy is to teach him how to use a smartphone that has alarms in it that go off that tell him to do everything like to remember to take his medication or remind him what his tasks are for the day. And then he has a method of checking each one of them off as he completes them. So when he gets home, he's able to share then with his family what chores he was able to get done that day and what the status was for them. So that's just kind of another example of a different kind of case.
Good. I think we're getting some feedback from somebody. It sounds like maybe on a cell phone. So if you could check that, maybe eliminate that and make it a little easier to hear. I had a question related to your earlier example on the bull case. Now, it sounds like that type of an example indicates that your solutions or your treatment has to be highly individualized to each.
Absolutely.
That'd be a correct interpretation?
That's absolutely true.
Especially, I would think, when you're dealing with animals. Now, one thing we've struggled with, I know, when there's either some type of head injury or a seizure disorder or other a problem like that is, you know, farmers generally want to drive a tractor. And I guess one kind of rule of thumb that we've used, because we're not, you know, experts in brain injury or in, you know, necessarily driving assessments or something like that, is
right.
Just generally say that, you know, if you're able to get a public driver's license, that's kind of one of the criteria we use for the ability to drive a tractor, because, you know, we don't want to send somebody out on a tractor that you know, might have a lapse or a seizure or something like that. Do you have any thoughts on that type of approach?
Well, I've got a number of thoughts. The first thing I want to say is that seizure management has changed a great deal over the last 5 years. Those folks that do not have a seizure within the first week of injury today are no longer being put on anticonvulsants because the research has demonstrated two things. That number one, if they haven't had a seizure, it's quite unlikely that they will have a seizure. But to make matters, but on the flip side, it turns out that the anticonvulsants probably aren't going to prevent the seizure if they're going to have it anyway. So what we are now doing is if someone has a seizure, within a week or so of injury. We do indeed place them on anticonvulsants. And in that scenario, the seizures, future seizures are likely to be prevented. If they do not have a seizure within a week of injury, we don't place them on an anticonvulsant. It used to be the case that they routinely were. And a very small percentage of people later will develop a seizure, and by that I mean 3 months, 6 months, 12 months down the road. But given the seizure medications that are available today, the vast majority of those are able to be managed. Secondly, we do indeed have driving evaluation protocols for people with neurologic disorders. And so most of your rehabilitation hospitals throughout the country will have that available for your patients. They can do a driving evaluation that includes an in-clinic portion as well as an on-the-road portion to evaluate someone's readiness to drive. And that's done by, you know, people that are sophisticated in the nature of the diagnosis. Third, your observation is very correct. That is, well, we were doing some further analyses of our data, and we found that those individuals that were able to return to driving were three times more likely to return to work. So being able to drive is an important deal. And that's one of the things that our resource facilitators aggressively manage to try and get that patient independent in that respect. So, and you know, things like medications can help with return to driving. Things like cognitive training or cognitive rehabilitation can help with return to driving. And then setting up real-world practice experiences to help them return to driving. So there's a variety of options in that respect.
Is that kind of assessment done routinely with all brain injuries, or is that something that's related to?
You know, I would like to say it's done with all brain injuries. I think it's not. I think it really depends on the sophistication of the medical community in which they're served, and the resources available.
Seems like that'd be a major push that maybe would, based on the return to work case, would be something really to work on, even with aggravability.
Yeah, well, you know, in Atlanta there is the Shepherd Rehabilitation Center. They have a course that they run on training people to do driving evaluations.
Hmm.
And if you email me, I can get you a contact there.
Mm-hmm.
Shepherd Center is actually a subcontractor on the Georgia Aggravability Grant. So,
oh, well, there you go.
Should be. I think there's somebody listed on our website that's with that center. So.
Gary, his last name is Ulary. He's the CEO. If you email him, I'm sure he'll get you to the right place.
You talked about using the smartphones as a memory aid. Are there similar things? I know I recently saw an article on an app that was specifically for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yep.
Other aids like that might be useful to know about?
There's a ton of them. There's a lot of them out there available. If you email me, I can hook you up with some resources in that respect. There's a couple of websites. My email is Lance, L-A-N-C-E, .Trexler, T-R-E-X-L-E-R, at R is in rehabilitation, H is in hospital, I is in Indiana, N is in network.com. You know, there are systems out there that are through the internet. There are pager alarm systems. So, for example, you can program a watch or a pager to remind a person to, you know, do this or do that. You can have it set so that there's routine things like take your medicine or novel things that are unique to that particular day. There's a variety of very there are some systems that can be set up in a home environment that will monitor, in the case of a person that's pretty impaired, will monitor if they leave the house when they're not supposed to, or whether they turn on the stove and they shouldn't, or if they've engaged in a behavior that, that's going to be problematic. The technological options are very, there's many of them today.
I'll plan to email you and send that list out to the whole group then after
sure.
we get our call.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
So you don't get bombarded by multiple emails on the same, asking the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation because so many times there are similar groups working or different groups working on similar issues, and there are lots of solutions we don't know about.
Yeah, sure.
So this has been very helpful.
Yeah.
We're talking about collaboration. I wanted to mention that we are planning our national conference for this November in Indianapolis. It goes from state to state, and this year it's going to be in Indiana.
Oh, you're kidding.
We've already talked to Cheryl Border at RHI, and she indicated that we might be able to arrange a possible tour and presentation out there. And I know she said the brain injury component is a key component, so that may be an opportunity for more direct collaboration with everybody.
Well, that would be great. You know, when you send that email, also I'd be interested in just, you know, submitting a paper on our resource facilitation work, maybe that I could present at your conference.
Sure, we'll send you a proposal application there.
That'd be great. So are you guys headed towards any new funding applications on which we might collaborate?
Well, that's a good question. I know here in Indiana we just submitted our proposal for the USDA funding for the next round. There's some question, of course, with where Congress is going with all of our funding. So,
just a little bit, huh?
Yeah, we did find that we're receiving funding through the end of fiscal year 2011, and we're working to make sure that stays in for the next round.
Right.
But yeah, if we're not, I'm not personally aware of specific brain injury related grants, but we are talking about maybe a grant to work with veterans, which would probably include brain injury.
Right.
So that's a possibility. But collaboration on things like that's always a good idea.
Yeah, we'd be happy to partner with you on that. We're interested in also testing whether or not we could provide resource facilitation to rural environments through a telehealth model.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem that there could be some opportunities there as well.
Okay.
But the other thing I think that one question I had is, how do people get identified for your services?
That's a good question, and sometimes a somewhat mysterious one, I think, if you ask different staff around the country. And I'll open it up for other states to give their feedback on that question. Here in Indiana, I'd say probably our greatest single source comes through referrals from state vocational rehabilitation.
Uh-huh.
They know pretty well about our program, and if they have somebody that's, you know, farm or rural, they'll tend to contact us. We get, you know, word of mouth kind of contacts from people. We get them through their website, and we spend a lot of time at farm shows and other conferences where we pick up a few contacts. So maybe some other people from around the country might be able to share their perspective on that too.
You know, one thing, in October we have our annual Brain Injury Association conference in Indiana, And I'm sure those of you out there in the other states, I'm sure your Brain Injury Association has an annual conference. One thing you may want to consider, and we'd love to have you in Indiana, if you'd want to do a sponsor a booth at our conference to reach professionals as well as consumers and advocates about your program.
Great.
So Anna Garrett here, our executive director, can help you with that.
All right.
But I'll do. I'll just send some information out there with out there to you. And so if you could share that with the rest of the group too, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other thoughts from the group? Any other questions, either general about TBI or specific about agricultural applications?
One thing I was just thinking, is there a standard kind of a form when they're in the hospital with a brain injury at the rehab center where they like can checklist through different resources like Agribility or others?
That's a beautiful question. Most brain injury associations will have a resource directory. And so where you would want to be is listed in that resource directory.
Mm-hmm. Good to know. And maybe that's something we can look at too, Paul.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, we just happened to be up redoing ours, so at least in Indiana, timing is right.
Because I know that's where you would look first, and yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I have a question about depression, and wondering if depression is—it may not be because of a traumatic brain injury, but it might be a result of dealing with chronic pain.
Sure.
And how do you? I have a patient who I think that might be a situation with, and his wife has talked about him. Dealing with depression, but he hasn't actually said anything about himself.
Right.
And it might be that situation with denial or just
right.
not wanting to recognize it.
Right.
But,
well, unfortunately, depression is a neurobiological problem. And when you are really depressed, not only... do you feel low, but you lack initiative and you lack the desire to do anything about it. And that's part of the problem with depression. So I think, you know, the wife has a couple of options. The first one is to consult with the family physician. That family physician should help that person develop some strategies to help get their spouse in to begin to address that issue. If the physician isn't familiar with how to do that, then they ought to consult with, you know, the local mental health center because they certainly have experience in folks that don't want to come in for treatment for a variety of reasons. But the very nature of the disorder itself is often what leads to their lack of initiation or lack of recognition or lack of desire to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Depression and pain is also very common, especially in chronic pain. And probably one of the better agents out there right now is Cymbalta or duloxetine. It has an indication
mm-hmm.
for both pain as well as for depression. And so that's often our first line of treatment.
Kind of a tangential, go ahead if you had to follow up on that.
No, I was just saying thanks.
It's kind of a tangential question on related to that. Is there a typical increase in family conflict or stress when we're dealing with TBI?
70% of marriages are dissolved within 5 years after a brain injury.
Yes, that's a yes.
Yes, so.
which often puts older adults caring for adult children again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay, we're coming to the close of our hour. Any other questions before we end?
All right. Well, thank you guys for your time very much. If again, contact your state brain injury association. They'll have a bunch of resources. We can follow up on those specific things that we discussed. Well, I appreciate your time very much.
Well, it's very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'll be emailing you with to get some of those resource lists and also give you more information about the workshop coming up in November, and hopefully we'll see you there.
All right, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.